Good evening. From our Newsfront studio at WNDT in New York, Wednesday, January 22, 1969, and this is Newsfront on the Eastern Educational Network. I'm Mitchell Krause, and tonight, the making of American foreign policy, an assessment of past, present, and future from former State Department Planning Council member Zbigniew Brzezinski and former Foreign Service Association, now Executive Director of the Association, Lannon Walker. Also, former Times editor Lester Markell on Nixon and the news media. But first, for a summary of the late news, here sitting in for Milt Haines is Bernard Eisman.
Good evening. In the Senate today, a bipartisan move to abolish the draft. 9 senators, 7 of them Republicans, calling for the creation of a professional volunteer army. President Nixon had called for an end to the draft system, but not until the war in Vietnam was over. Today's bill would end conscription 6 months after passage of the law. Walter Hickel, Richard Nixon's choice for Interior Secretary, wasn't confirmed by the Senate today, as critics continue to contend that the Alaska governor is unfit for the job. GOP senators defended him. The matter will finally come to a vote tomorrow afternoon. Confirmation is expected, despite the bitter arguments his nomination has sparked. The Navy advised the Pueblo captain of his rights today, telling him he's liable to prosecution for violating military law when the North Koreans seized his ship. Commander Lloyd Boucher was also warned that anything he says about his actions could be held against him. Naval regulations say a commander must not surrender while he still has power to resist. Boucher said he had no chance to fight from the very moment the North Koreans came aboard. Treasury Secretary David Kennedy pledged today that the Nixon administration will move decisively to offset inflation. Kennedy, after a meeting with President Nixon, said, however, they would avoid any abrupt action that would cause unnecessary unemployment. He said he was aware of the risks in trying to offset inflation. Earlier in the day, Budget Director Robert Mayo said the 10% surtax on income will stand, although budget reductions could reduce it. From Czechoslovakia today, reports of hunger strikes in memory of John Palach, the first of 2 Czechs to burn themselves to death protesting Soviet occupation. Police tried to break up a public hunger strike in Prague, while others went on in at least 4 university cities. A 3rd young Czech tried self-immolation today. He's alive and in fair condition. Officials say he had tried suicide before. Foreign Minister Abba Eban told Israel's parliament today that withdrawal from occupied Arab territory under Soviet terms would further Arab guerrilla efforts against Israel. Eban said he made his statement in response to a speech in Cairo Monday by Egyptian President Nasser. Among other things, Nasser pledged unconditional support for the Palestine terrorist groups. France's President Charles de Gaulle went out of his way to slap former Premier Georges Pompidou. Pompidou, replaced as Premier last summer, had said he expected to be a presidential candidate whenever an election is held. De Gaulle, who was 78, said he has the duty and intention to fulfill his mandate. Despite de Gaulle's statement, speculation grows that he might be thinking of retirement before his term runs out in 1972. In Vietnam today, American air cavalrymen moved in on an enemy base north of Saigon. They claimed to have seized the 2nd largest munitions cache taken in the war. The U.S. command says 30 tons of rocket shells and mortars were found in bunkers 60 miles north of Saigon. And this final note, Jairus Leonard, a Milwaukee attorney, has been named to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Leonard has been a member of the racially restricted Fraternal Order of Eagles in Milwaukee. The Justice Department says he'll quit soon. That's the news from our newsroom in New York. I'm Bernard Eisman. Now Newsfront continues.
Recent American Secretaries of State, John Foster Dulles, who led the Eisenhower foreign policy, Dean Rusk, who just ended his 8 years as Foreign Secretary to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, and William Rogers, who just assumed the top job at State, the vast department responsible for relations with the nations of the world. Are changes in the process of policymaking in store, and what should they be? The assessment of 2 authorities who have studied the problem in depth. Zbigniew Brzezinski, a former member of the State Department Policy Planning Council and now professor of government and director of the Research Institute on Communist Affairs at Columbia University. And Lannon Walker, now a member of the Executive Secretariat of the Department of State, a Foreign Service officer and Executive Secretary of the American Foreign Service Association.
Mr. Walker.
Speaker, the Secretary of State, William Rogers, today indicated that he wants to have an open-door policy within the foreign policy establishment. He said he hopes to stimulate greater debate so that dissenting views, particularly from younger officers, would get full consideration in forming U.S. policies. And he said he was willing to listen to critics as well as supporters of policy. Why is this a news-making item, Professor Brzezinski?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a news-making item. I'm all in favor of many options, open doors, quiet voices. But I think it's about time we heard from the Nixon people what their policies are going to be. And I would much rather hear less talk about options, initiatives, willingness to listen, and more of an indication what sort of leadership is going to be provided. And I think this is a very important point, because the Secretary of State should be the principal initiator of foreign policy in this country. And I think the problem is that the way the administration is structured, and this applies to the last few administrations, is that it's very difficult for him to be the effective initiator. And the more time passes, the less he asserts himself, the more difficult it will be for him later on to assert himself effectively.
I'd like to get Mr. Walker's reaction, because the question immediately arises as to, well, for heaven's sakes, aren't they listening to what is being suggested from down the echelon?
I think that professionals are very pleased, or would be very pleased, to hear Secretary Rogers' statement. As you may perhaps know, we've been involved in a reform movement for a year now within the foreign policy establishment, and basically what we've been about is saying that professionals for the first time may have some ideas about the organization of the policy process, how to turn the organization on, and how to reform the personnel structures. It's extremely important to us as operators who see the system work to know that we can get ideas across and that professionals' opinions will be listened to and respected. I agree with much of what Professor Brzezinski has said, but I think just as important as a new policy or policy leadership is the very mechanism itself by which the policy is formulated.
Well, speaking of the mechanism, again, the whole problem in bureaucracies, I'm told, always seems to be that the bureaucracy keeps growing and developing, and there's always so much to do that happens as of the moment, not only in foreign affairs but in domestic affairs, that unless there's a Hoover Commission study, one never gets a chance to look at it again and to try to see where perhaps one went wrong.
Well, my colleague here has written, I think, a very important article for Foreign Affairs, which deals with the problem of structural reform. I have, in my own modest way, tried to write on the same subject in Public Interest, and we both deal, I think, with the problem of relating institutional organization to policymaking. And I don't want to speak for him, but speaking for myself, I feel very strongly that the State Department, in which I have served recently, is not structured today for the sake of effectively asserting policy leadership. And unless the Secretary of State uses the next few weeks to appoint key people around him to fill policy slots, to give him policy guidance, and structures them organizationally in such a way that they can assert themselves effectively over ongoing decisions, he's going to find himself completely outdistanced and outmaneuvered by the White House staff and also by other institutions and departments in government, including defense, particularly defense.
Maybe we could be a little more specific about the kind of positions, if not indeed the names and titles, that would be involved surrounding the Secretary of State in formulating these both policy changes and structural changes.
If I understand Professor Brzezinski correctly, he would, in one of his options, have the policy planning staff reduced in size, made more intimately related to the Secretary of State, and impose, if you will, policy direction upon the operating structure of the various departments. I happen to feel, and I think that most of the professionals that have been involved in our reform study over the last year would relate the policy planning process much more closely to operations. We would put it in the first echelon down with the Assistant Secretary, for example.
Yes, well, I think we would disagree, because my view would be that to some extent that is the ongoing system. And the effect is that policy planning becomes either the solution of ongoing problems, because these are the concerns which most involve the operators, ongoing problems, or in effect extension of ongoing policy. Now, if you look back historically and ask who were the great secretaries of state, they were essentially Marshall, Dulles, and Acheson, whether one agrees with their policies or not. And these were men who either personally or by the organization of their staff imposed a grand conception on the entire administration, and the concept filtered downward and then asserted itself through policy execution. And accordingly, I feel that the Secretary of State ought to have around him an intimately linked staff of key advisors who would operate on a level higher than the assistant secretary, particularly as far as their chief is concerned. And on the basis of whose assistance, he will be then able to play the political game vis-a-vis the president, the National Security Council, the Department of Defense, and downward in the Department of State. Otherwise, he just becomes a manager. And you can have effective management, but no policy leadership.
Well, now, you did mention Secretary Rusk in your enumeration of the great secretaries of the past. And I wondered where you felt, Professor Brzezinski, that Secretary Rusk was failing in the concept as you laid it out.
Well, I have the greatest admiration for Secretary Rusk. I think he's an extraordinarily honorable, courageous, dedicated man. He happens to have been Secretary of State at a time when the two presidents whom he was serving were themselves highly assertive individuals who provided overall leadership in the field of foreign policy. And the Secretary himself, as far as I can gauge, was not a man who was interested in analyzing the conceptual direction of foreign policy, and particularly not interested in initiating it himself and then asserting it downwards. He defined his role much more in the specific and exclusive definition of the term secretary. He was secretary to the president for foreign affairs. He was not a leader in the field of foreign policy.
Walker, do you have?
Yeah, I'd just like to pick up on what Professor Brzezinski said. I think that we agree so fundamentally on the need for planning that I would like to get at this problem of just where you're located and how much, let's say, the professional Foreign Service officer is in that process. For the last 20 years, and including the three great secretaries you mentioned, the disrelation or unrelation of the planning process to the operators, to the professionals themselves, have created a personnel structure and people like me who are nothing but operators. And one of the things that's fundamental, it strikes me, to reform in this government, in foreign affairs, is to turn the professionals around so that they begin to think in planning terms as well as in operational terms. And you won't do this unless you get them involved in it, unless you begin to tell them that this is the way they too should think, that there's more involved than just operations. It would strike me that planning, one of its functions, is coordination and understanding and participation. Only to the degree that you sort of understand the hang-ups that went into the policy are you going to be able to carry it out within its parameters.
Yes, well, I would agree with that, but I would say that coordination and integration is a facet of planning. It's that facet of planning which involves the execution of planning, making it meaningful. And the plan which isn't executed remains a disembodied abstraction. So I agree. But the problem is, where does the plan initiate? Who conceives it? What are the opportunities for developing a sustained, effective, directed, deliberate foreign policy?
Well, I'd like
and
to,
you can't get that out of too intimate involvement with operations, because then foreign policy becomes merely a continuity of what you have been doing in the past.
Let's see if we could, at this point, break it down into its parts, because I think many of our viewers are not at all familiar with the structure that we're talking about. You have in the State Department, as I would look at what you said a moment ago, the Secretary of State in the hoped-for leadership role, as Professor Brzezinski indicated, the assistant secretaries and all of the personnel who are in the field as the operational people who carry out policy, and the Policy Planning Council, am I correct, which ostensibly formulates and recommends policy directions and policy itself. Right. And your concept, Professor Brzezinski, is to get the planners in the Policy Planning Council to have more authority, more opportunity to present their plans, and the operators then to follow the plans and proposals, and
yes,
the secretary to lead the whole machinery.
Right. Ideally, I believe in a policy-initiating Secretary of State. A policy-initiating Secretary of State is a secretary who plays a decisive role in foreign policy, and I think we agree on that.
Fine.
The problem is how to get him to be a policy initiator. Well, this, in the first instance, involves a matter of personality. He has to be an assertive type. But beyond that, he has to have an intellectual basis from which to be assertive. And you can only get that if you have an intimate staff closely related to yourself as Secretary of State.
This would be the Policy Planning
and this
Council.
Ought to be the Policy Planning Council, composed of senior, independently minded advisors. As it has been constituted in the last few years, the Policy Planning Council, though composed of very many able people and certainly very ably directed, has operated essentially on the same level as the geographical and functional bureaus. And the fact is that operators like efficiency and continuity. They don't like discontinuity. And the Policy Planning Council on that level with a relatively disinterested secretary cannot assert itself.
Well, Mr. Walker, though, you would tend to disagree, it would seem to me, that in this reduced role for the area secretaries and the ambassadors, as Professor Brzezinski has laid it out, their ability to initiate policy direction seems somewhat limited.
I think in essence, we're both after the same thing. I think that in the last, certainly the last 4 years, the Policy Planning Council, as it is now known, is totally unrelated either to policy or to operations.
Professor Brzezinski said they do a lot of speech writing at campaign time.
And to good effect, as he pointed out. I'd really wonder whether moving that council up the hall on the seventh floor and putting it closer to the Secretary of State and even binding intimate relationships there will improve a great deal more the problems that we face in foreign affairs. I think that policy planning must be much more intimately related to programs, to the budget cycle, and right down to the operational network of the way things are carried on. And I feel, rather than bring, if you will, independent minds from the outside in and hope that this relationship with the secretary will impose a downward flow of direction upon our foreign affairs, I'd like to see a mix of insiders and outsiders intimately related to the policy process.
But then I wonder whether in that case your meaning of planning is indifferent from mine. My meaning of planning is really policy initiative, policy direction, policy integration, the development of a grand concept.
This is a grand design, such as
I understand
America
your
should
definition,
be oriented toward Europe, or
that's right, or what the global role of America ought to be, and so forth. As I understand your concept of planning, at least in the terms which you have now defined it, it sounds to me much more as efficiency seeking and integration, coordination, which I think are more operational concepts than policy concepts.
I would just like to relate the grand design to the way in which we carry out our business a little bit more. Right. If we have a grand design and we're going to be more intimately related with Africa, how are we going to do it? If this involves a transfer of resources, how much does it cost, and what are the trade-offs between using our cultural resources, for example, in a cultural affairs program? Do they all go to Northern Africa? Yeah. Or to Southern Africa, or what do? Do we use a regional approach? And there you get in, you see, you're relating it much more closely to programs, the cultural exchange program, the budget cycle, in a different way. And I don't think that these things are opposites by any means.
No, if I just make a comment. I agree with that. I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that this is an aspect which I either underestimate or ignore. But I think one has to think of the making of foreign policy, of defining foreign policy, as involving a vertical relationship downwards to people below you in terms of execution, and then sort of a horizontal relationship to other competitive agencies. And I have particularly in mind the Defense Department and the White House staff. Mm-hmm. And unless the Secretary has a capacity, a closely, intimately linked staff, which provides them the basis for developing concepts and for fighting for them in the White House, against the Defense Department, against the White House staff, then he's not going to assert himself.
Well, now, as we all know, and as you pointed out a moment ago, Professor Brzezinski and Mr. Walker, personalities here are essential in the government structure so often. There's a great range of flexibility in just what is done with an organizational structure. And I wonder if we could look at what appear at the moment, at least, to be the three key personalities involved. The new Secretary of State, Mr. Rogers, the policy planning chief for the President in Foreign Affairs, his advisor, Henry Kissinger, and the President himself, Mr. Nixon. Professor Brzezinski, could you look at these three people and see what you think will evolve here in the immediate future in regard
to this? Well, I know only one of them well personally. I won't say which one. I have admiration for all three. I think Henry Kissinger is an extraordinarily able person, a great conceptualizer, a person who has a sense of the larger picture. However, as he defines his role, at least publicly, he sees it essentially as that of providing the president with clear-cut options, essentially a neutral, integrating role. And he has chosen for himself a very competent staff of essentially middle-level officials who are essentially technicians, skilled operators, but not policy initiators. So at least at the present moment, he's structured towards integration, though he personally has the capacity for general conceptualization. Mr. Laird is a very able, energetic, assertive type, defense secretary. Mr. Rogers, from everything I know about him, is a very skillful man, a man who has a sense of power, of personal relationships, and I would assume that he is ambitious and intends to play the role of a quote-unquote Secretary of State. Well, so that the picture of the present moment is mixed. He doesn't have the staff. Kissinger has the staff. Laird, of course, has a Department of Defense, and if he gets a good ISA chief, that is to say Assistant Secretary for International Security Affairs, he'll be able to compete in the game. I think Rogers, right now, is operating with certain handicaps. He doesn't have himself the policy background, and he doesn't have the immediate staff. He does have a close relationship with the president and personal skills. So I think it's an open game.
Well, now, how will this differ? I want to get Mr. Walker's comment in just a moment. But how will this differ, Professor Brzezinski, with what the situation was in the recent past under Johnson and Rusk and his foreign affairs advisor, Mr. Rostow?
I think Mr. Mundy, who was obviously very important in policy,
McGeorge Bundy,
was a man who tended to serve the function that Henry Kissinger and President Nixon have talked about, of integrating and providing options. Now, in doing that, you can, of course, influence policy. Mr. Rostow, I think, was much more of an ideologue who actually influenced policy and provided historical direction. I think it really depends more on Mr. Rogers than on anyone else what kind of a role the White House staff will play
in
this
Mr.
administration.
Nixon, what does he seem to want out of this?
Well, Mr. Nixon talks in terms of having a staff which provides options, but at the same time he says, I'm experienced in international politics, this is mine field. And this, of course, leaves the secretary in an ambivalent position. If the secretary develops a program, assertive policy leadership, he can play, I think, a really crucial role. But I think it's up to him.
Mr. Walker, what would be your comment in this area, sensitive for you, being in the State Department at the present time?
I think that it seems, at least it strikes me, that the new administration has a predilection, more so than the old, for structuring the mechanics of, in this particular instance, policy planning into the operational network. There's a lot of string to play out yet. And I think both as I've said and as Professor Brzezinski have said, there's only so much you can do with structure, so much you can do with institutional reform, and so much depends upon the commitment to that. And the way, really, that you turn a whole organization around and make people involved and tell them that they begin to act in different ways, there's really the kicker in it. It's commitment from above. There, I'd certainly agree.
Well, we just have one moment. I wanted to get a final comment from Professor Brzezinski, and that is that we are in this period of flux. But as you view it now, Professor Brzezinski, if a crisis should erupt in this period now, what kind of response would we get? A new response or a response of an old design?
Well, I should think if the crisis came soon, the momentum would be in the direction of a response derived from immediate past experience.
And the foreign governments that may be involved in such matters undoubtedly are looking with great interest on this structural underpinning of our policymaking apparatus. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think this provides them with very important clues.
So that as far as our policy is concerned, the sooner we get the ship in shape, the better off we'll be in the foreign affairs field.
The less likely we're to sink.
Yes. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Lennon Walker and Professor Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Thank you.
Now, Newsfront commentary. Here's former Times editor Lester Markell with an assessment of President Nixon and his coming relations with the media.
Word for it. Charisma, meaning a kind of mass sex appeal, divinely bestowed. Now the word charisma occupies a top place in the political lexicons. Which brings us to President Nixon and television and the intricate and fascinating problem of communication. Communication is probably the new president's number one problem. There are, of course, Vietnam and the Middle East, the racial issue and inflation, and all the countless other perplexities. But none of these can be solved unless Mr. Nixon has the confidence of the nation. This means that he must be candid in his reports, convincing in his arguments for his programs. It means also that he must be leader as well as executive, inspirer as well as innovator. In the light of the Johnsonian experience, it means decidedly that there must be no credibility gap. In sum, Mr. Nixon must communicate with the country. He cannot be a voice, however eloquent, crying out in a wilderness of non-listeners. Which brings us back to charisma. This is why such communication these days, rightly or wrongly, is in the main achieved through television. Press conferences, public oratory, fireside or Key Biscayne chats, and the rest of the gamut of presidential pronouncements. The Marshall McLuhan theory may be cockeyed, and if I understood it, I might say it was. But in the case of television, the medium surely comes close to being the message, or the massage, or the rubdown, or whatnot. And it is largely through television that charisma is projected or rejected. Well then, how good is Mr. Nixon as a television performer? How in this area does he compare with his predecessors? There was Eisenhower, who despite his lapses in syntax and grammar, and there were many, conveyed an impression of sincerity and honesty. There was Kennedy, whose charm enabled him to get away with a good deal. That, without the Camelot touch, might have been questioned. There was Johnson, whose TV image did not do him justice because of the comparison with Kennedy and his reputation as a wheeler dealer. And now there's Nixon, who, with uncertain timing and misplaced gestures, has failed to achieve a place on television even approaching that of Eisenhower or Kennedy. Incidentally, the inaugural address was a decided departure from the Nixon norm. Mr. Nixon then faces the challenge of the not-so-silver screen and must meet it more successfully than did his predecessor. Lyndon Johnson will have in history, and I believe this profoundly, a much higher place than that presently accorded to him. He made mistakes of pronouncement and concealment, but he had a bad press, much of it unfair, and he failed to come across on television. Now, I'm not suggesting that a successful TV image is the single clue to a successful presidency. I am only suggesting that without it, the qualities that make for a great, even good president cannot prevail. All this is in a way deplorable. It is regrettable that a president's manner should be adjudged more important than his philosophy, that his image shall be held in greater esteem than his spirit. Yet this is the fact, and a fact that must be faced. We can only hope that eventually the nation will make less superficial judgments and look beyond the image into the man himself and his works. In these critical days, the man who inhabits that fate-haunted oval room must formulate sound programs, implement them with persuasion and persistence, evoke a wide and eager response in the nation. Such is the essence of leadership. The key word is inspiration. Inspiration through deed and through word. Inspiration through communication. Charisma, yes, but much more.
NewsFront is brought to you through the facilities of the Eastern Educational Network.